Like a great black wasp, the helicopter droned across the Nevada Badlands. Roy was still wearing the telephone headset with the saucer-sized earphones, blocking out the engine and rotor noise to concentrate on the photograph of Stephen Ackblom. The loudest sound in his private realm was the slow, heavy thudding of his heart. When Ackblom's secret work had been exposed, Roy had been only 16 years old and still confused about the meaning of life and about his own place in the world. He was drawn to beautiful things, the paintings of Child Hassam and so many others, classical music, antique French furniture, Chinese porcelain, lyrical poetry. He was always a happy boy when alone in his room with Beethoven or Bach on the stereo, gazing at the color photographs in a book about Fabergé eggs, Paul Store silver, or Sung Dynasty porcelains. Likewise, he was happy when he was wandering alone through an art museum. He was seldom happy around people, however, although he wanted desperately to have friends and to be liked. In his expansive but guarded heart, young Roy was convinced that he had been born to make an important contribution to the world, and he knew that when he discovered what his contribution would be, he would then become widely admired and loved. Nevertheless, at 16, and bedeviled by the impatience of youth, he was enormously frustrated by the need to wait for his purpose and his destiny to be revealed to him. He had been fascinated by the newspaper accounts of the Ackblom tragedy because in the mystery of the artist's double life, he had sensed a resolution to his own deep confusion. He acquired two books with color plates of Ackblom's art and responded powerfully to the work. Though Ackblom's pictures were beautiful, even ennobling, Roy's enthusiasm wasn't aroused only by the paintings themselves. He was also affected by the artist's inner struggle, which he inferred from the paintings and which he believed to be similar to his own. Basically, Stephen Ackblom was preoccupied with two subjects and produced two types of paintings. Although only in his mid-30s, he had been obsessed enough to produce an enormous body of work consisting half of exceptionally beautiful still lives. Fruit, vegetables, stones, flowers, pebbles, the contents of a sewing box, buttons, tools, plates, a collection of old bottles, bottle caps. Humble and exalted objects alike were rendered in remarkable detail, so realistic that they seemed three-dimensional. In fact, each item attained a hyper-reality, appeared to be more real than the object that had served as the model for it, and possessed an eerie beauty. Ackblom never resorted to the forced beauty of sentimentality or unrestrained romanticism. His vision was always convincing, moving, and sometimes breathtaking. The subjects of the remainder of the paintings were people, portraits of individuals and of groups containing 3 to 7 subjects. More frequently, they were faces rather than full figures, but when they were figures, they were invariably nudes. Sometimes Ackblom's men, women, and children were ethereally beautiful on the surface, though their comeliness was always tainted by a subtle but terrible pressure within them, as if some monstrous possessing spirit might explode from their fragile flesh at any moment. This pressure distorted a feature here and there, not dramatically, but just enough to rob them of perfect beauty. And sometimes the artist portrayed ugly, even grotesque individuals, within whom there was also fearful pressure, though its effect was to force a feature here and there to conform to an ideal beauty. Their malformed countenances were all the more chilling for being, in some aspects, lightly touched by grace. As a consequence of the conflict between inner and outer realities, the people in both types of portraits were enormously expressive, although their expressions were more mysterious and haunting than any that enlivened the faces of real human beings. Seizing on those portraits, the news media had been quick to make the most obvious interpretation. They claimed that the artist, himself a handsome man, had been painting his own demon within, crying out for help or issuing a warning regarding his true nature. Although he was only 16, Roy Muro understood that Ackblom's paintings were not about the artist himself, but about the world as he perceived it. Ackblom had no need to cry out for help or to warn anyone, for he didn't see himself as demonic. Taken as a whole, what his art said was that no human being could ever achieve the perfect beauty of even the humblest object in the inanimate world. Ackblom's great paintings helped young Roy to understand why he was delighted to be alone with the artistic works of human beings, yet was often unhappy in the company of human beings themselves. No work of art could be flawless because an imperfect human being had created it. Yet art was the distillation of the best in humanity. Therefore, works of art were closer to perfection than those who created them. Favoring the inanimate over the animate was all right. It was acceptable to value art above people. That was the first lesson he learned from Stephen Ackblom. Wanting to know more about the man, Roy had discovered that the artist was not surprisingly extremely private and seldom spoke to anyone for publication. Roy managed to find two interviews. In one, Ekblom held forth with great feeling and compassion about the misery of the human condition. One quotation seemed to leap from the text. "Love is the most human of all emotions because love is messy. And of all the things we can feel with our minds and bodies, severe pain is the purest. For it drives everything else from our awareness and focuses us as perfectly as we can ever be focused." Ekblom had pleaded guilty to the murders of his wife and 41 others, rather than face a lengthy trial that he couldn't win. In the courtroom, entering his plea, the painter had disgusted and angered the judge by saying of his 42 victims, "They were all so beautiful in their pain, and all like angels when they died." Roy began to understand what Ekblom had been doing in those rooms under the barn. In subjecting his victims to torture, the artist was trying to focus them toward a moment of perfection, when they would briefly shine, even though still alive, with a beauty equal to that of inanimate objects. Purity and beauty were the same thing. Pure lines, pure forms, pure light, pure color, pure sound, pure emotion, pure thought, pure faith, pure ideals. However, human beings were capable of achieving purity in any thought or endeavor only rarely, and only in extreme circumstances, which made the human condition pitiable. That was the second lesson he learned from Stephen Ekblom. For a few years, Roy's heartfelt pity for humanity intensified and matured. One day, shortly after his 20th birthday, as a bud suddenly blossoms into a full-blown rose, his pity became compassion. He considered the latter to be a purer emotion than the former. Pity often entailed a subtle element of disgust for the object of pity, or a sense of superiority on the part of the person who felt pity for another. But compassion was an unpolluted, crystalline, piercing empathy for other people, a perfect understanding of their suffering. Guided by compassion, acting on frequent opportunities to make the world a better place, confident of the purity of his motivation, Roy had then become a more enlightened man than Stephen Ekblom. He had found his destiny. Now, 13 years later, sitting in the back of the executive helicopter as it carried him toward Utah, Roy smiled at the photograph of the artist in swarming shadows. Funny how everything in life seemed connected to everything else. A forgotten moment or half-remembered face from the past could suddenly become important again. The artist had never been so central a figure in Roy's life that he could have been called a mentor or even an inspiration. Roy had never believed that Ekblom was a madman, as the media had portrayed him, but saw him as merely misguided. The best answer to the hopelessness of the human condition was not to grant one moment of pure beauty to each imperfect soul by the elevating effect of severe pain. That was a pathetically transient triumph. The better answer was to identify those most in need of release, then, with dignity and compassion and merciful speed, set them free of their imperfect human condition. Nevertheless, at a crucial time, the artist had unknowingly taught a few vital truths to a confused boy. Though Stephen Ekblom was a misguided and tragic figure, Roy owed him a debt. It was ironic, and an intriguing example of cosmic justice, that Roy should be the one to rid the world of the troubled and thankless son who had betrayed Ekblom. The artist's quest for human perfection had been misguided, but in Roy's view, well-meaning. Their sorry world would inch closer to an ideal state with Michael, now Spencer, removed from it. And pure justice seemed to require that Spencer be removed only subsequent to being subjected to prolonged and severe pain in a manner that would adequately honor his visionary father. As Roy took off the telephone headset, he heard the pilot making an announcement on the public address system.
"According to Vegas Control, allowing for the target's current speed, we're approximately 16 minutes from rendezvous. 16 minutes to the target."
A sky like blue glass, 17 miles to Cedar City. They began to encounter more traffic on the two-lane highway. Ellie used the horn to encourage slow vehicles to get out of her way. When the drivers were stubborn, she took nail-biting risks to get around them in no-passing zones, or even pass them to the right when the shoulder of the highway was wide enough. Their speed dropped because of the interference that the traffic posed, but the need for increased recklessness made it seem as though they were actually going faster than ever. Spencer held on to one edge of his seat. In the back, Rocky was bobbing his head again.
"Even without proof," Spencer suggested, "you could go to the press. You could point them in the right direction, put Summerton on the defensive."
"Tried that twice.
First, a New York Times reporter contacted her on her office computer, had an online dialogue, and set up a meeting at an Indian restaurant. Made it clear if she told anyone, anyone at all, my life and hers wouldn't be worth spit. I got there 4 hours early, watched the place with binoculars from the roof of a building across the street to be sure she came alone and there wasn't any obvious stakeout. I figured I'd make her wait, go in half an hour late, take the extra time to watch the street. But 15 minutes after she arrived, the restaurant blew up. Gas explosion, so the police said.
The reporter?
Dead, along with 14 other people in there.
Dear God.
Then a week later, a guy from the Washington Post was supposed to meet me in a public park. I actually set it up with a cellular phone from another rooftop overlooking that site, but not obvious enough to be seen. Made it for 6 hours later. About an hour and a half go by, and then a water department truck pulls up near the park. The work crew opens a manhole, sets out some safety cones and sawhorses with flashes on them.
But they weren't really city workers.
I had a battery-powered multiband scanner with me on that roof. Picked up the frequency they were using to coordinate the phony work crew with a phony lunch wagon on the other side of the park.
You are something else, he said admiringly.
3 agents in the park, too. One pretending he's a panhandler, 2 pretending to be Park Service employees doing maintenance. Then the time comes and the reporter shows up, walks to the monument where I told him we'd meet, and the son of a bitch is wired, too. I hear him muttering to them that he doesn't see me anywhere. What should he do? And they're calming him, telling him it's cool, he should just wait. The little weasel must have been in Tom Summerton's pocket, called him up right after talking to me. 10 miles west of Cedar City, they pulled behind a Dodge pickup that was doing 10 miles per hour under the legal limit. At the rear window of the cab, 2 rifles hung in a rack. The pickup driver let Ellie pound on the horn for a while, mule stubborn about pulling over to let her by. What's wrong with this jerk? She fumed. She gave him more horn, but he played deaf. As far as he knows, we have someone dying in here, needs a doctor, fast.
Hell, these days we could be a couple of lunatic dopers just spoiling for a shootout.
The man in the pickup was moved by neither compassion nor fear. Finally, he responded to the horn by putting his arm out the window and flipping Ellie the finger. Passing to the left was impossible at the moment. Visibility was limited, and what highway they could see was occupied by a steady stream of oncoming traffic. Spencer looked at his watch. They had only 15 minutes left from the 2-hour safety margin that Ellie had estimated. The man in the pickup, however, seemed to have all the time in the world. Jackass, she said, and whipped the Rover to the right, trying to get around the slow vehicle by using the shoulder of the highway. When she pulled even with the Dodge, it accelerated to match her speed. Twice Ellie pumped more juice to the Rover, twice it leaped forward, and twice the pickup matched her new pace. The other driver repeatedly glanced away from the road to glare at them. He was in his 40s, under a baseball cap. His face revealed all the intelligence of a shovel. Clearly, he intended to pace Ellie until the shoulder narrowed and she was forced to fall in behind him again. Shovel Face didn't know what kind of woman he was dealing with, of course, but Ellie promptly showed him. She pulled the Rover to the left, bashing the pickup hard enough to startle the driver into shifting his foot off the accelerator. The pickup lost speed. The Rover shot ahead. Shovel Face jammed the pedal again, but he was too late. Ellie swung the Rover onto the pavement in front of the Dodge. As the Rover lurched left, then right, Rocky yelped with surprise, then fell onto his side. He scrambled into his sitting position again and snorted in what might have been either embarrassment or delight. Spencer looked at his watch. You think they'll hook up with local cops before they come after us? No, they'll try to keep the locals out of it.
Then what should we be looking for?
If they fly in from Vegas or anywhere else, I think they'll be in a chopper. More maneuverability, flexibility. With satellite tracking, they can pinpoint the Rover, come right in over us, and blow us off the highway if they get a chance.
Leaning forward, Spencer peered through the windshield at the threatening blue sky. A horn blared behind them.
Damn, Ellie said, glancing at her side mirror.
Checking the mirror on his side, Spencer saw that the Dodge had caught up with them. The angry driver was pounding his horn as Ellie had pounded hers earlier.
We don't need this right now, she worried.
Okay, Spencer said. So let's see if he'll take a rain check on a shootout. If we survive the agency, then we'll come back and give him a fair whack at us.
Think he'd go for that?
Seems like a reasonable man.
Pressing the Rover as hard as ever, Ellie managed to glance at Spencer and smile.
You're getting the attitude.
It's contagious.
Here and there, scattered along both sides of the highway, were businesses, houses. This wasn't quite yet Cedar City, but they were definitely back in civilization. The slug in the Dodge pickup pounded on the horn with such enthusiasm that every blast must have been sending a thrill through his groin. On the display screen in the open attaché case relayed from Las Vegas was the view from EarthGuard, enormously magnified and enhanced, looking down on the state highway just west of Cedar City. The Range Rover was pulling one reckless stunt after another. Sitting in the back of the chopper with the open case on his lap, Roy was riveted by the performance, which was like something out of an action movie, though seen from one monotonous angle. No one drove that fast, weaving lane to lane, sometimes facing down oncoming traffic, unless he was drunk or being pursued. This driver wasn't drunk. There was nothing sloppy about the way the Rover was being handled. It was rash, daredevil driving, but it was also skillful. And from all appearances, the Rover was not being chased. Roy was finally convinced that the woman was behind the wheel of that vehicle. After being alarmed by the satellite traceback to her computer, she would never take comfort from the fact that no pursuit car was racing up her tailpipe. She knew that they either would be waiting ahead for her at a roadblock or would take her out from the air. Before either of these things happened, she was trying to get into a town where she could blend into a busy flow of traffic and use whatever architecture of the urban landscape might help her to escape their eyes. Cedar City wasn't nearly large enough, of course, to provide her with the opportunities she needed. Evidently, she underestimated the power and clarity of surveillance from orbit. At the front of the chopper's passenger compartment, the four strike force officers were checking their weapons. They distributed spare magazines of ammunition in their pockets. Civilian clothing was the uniform for this mission. They wanted to get in, nail the woman, capture Grant, and get out before Cedar City law enforcement showed up. If they became involved with the locals, they would only have to deceive them, and deception involved the risk of making mistakes and being unmasked, especially when they had no idea how much Grant knew and what he might say if the cops insisted on talking to him. Besides, dealing with locals also took too much damn time. Both choppers were marked with phony registration numbers to misguide observers. As long as the men wore no identifying clothing or gear, witnesses would have little or nothing useful to tell the police later. Every member of the strike force, including Roy, was protected by a bullet-resistant body vest under his clothes and was carrying Drug Enforcement Administration ID that could be produced quickly to placate the local authorities if necessary. If they were lucky, however, they would be back in the air 3 minutes after touching down, with Spencer Grant in custody, with the woman's body, but with no wounded of their own. The woman was finished. She was still breathing, still had a heartbeat, but in fact she was already stone dead. On the computer in Roy's lap, EarthGuard 3 showed the target drastically slowing. Then the Rover passed another vehicle, perhaps a pickup, on the shoulder of the highway. The pickup increased its speed, too, and suddenly a drag race seemed to be underway. Frowning, Roy squinted at the display screen. The pilot announced that they were 5 minutes from the target. Cedar City. There was too much traffic to facilitate their escape and too little to allow them to blend in and confuse EarthGuard. She was also hindered by being on streets with gutters instead of on open highways with wide shoulders and traffic lights, and that stupid pickup jockey insistently pounding on his horn. Ellie turned right at an intersection, frantically surveying both sides of the street, fast food restaurants, service stations, convenience stores. She had no idea exactly what she was looking for. She only knew that she would recognize it when she saw it, a place or situation that they could turn to their advantage. She had hoped for time to scout the territory and find a way to get the Rover undercover. A grove of evergreens with a dense canopy of branches, a large parking garage, any place in which they might evade the eyes in the sky and leave the Rover without being spotted. Then they could either buy or heist new wheels, and from orbit they would again be indistinguishable from other vehicles on the highway. She supposed she would earn a bed of nails in Hades for sure if she killed the creep in the Dodge pickup, but the satisfaction might be worth the price. He hammered on the horn as if he were a confused and angry ape, determined to beat the damn thing until it stopped bleeding at him. He also tried to get around them during every break in oncoming traffic, but Ellie swerved to block him. The passenger side of the pickup was badly scraped and crumpled from when she had bashed into it with the Rover, so the guy probably figured that he had nothing to lose by pulling alongside and forcing her to the curb. She couldn't let him do that. They were quickly running out of time. Having to deal with the ape would consume precious minutes. "Tell me it's not," Spencer shouted above the blaring horn. "Not what?" Then she realized that he was pointing through the windshield, something in the sky, to the southwest. Two large executive-style helicopters, one behind and to the left of the other, both black. The polished hulls and windows glistened as if sheathed with ice, and the morning sun shimmered off the whirling rotors.
The two craft were like huge insects out of an apocalyptic 1950s science fiction movie about the dangers of nuclear radiation, less than 2 miles away. She saw a U-shaped strip shopping center ahead on the left. Skating on the fragile ice of instinct, she accelerated, hung a hard left through a gap in traffic, and drove into a short access road that served the big parking lot. Near her right ear, the dog was panting with excitement, and it sounded uncannily like soft laughter. Spencer still had to shout because the hornblower remained close behind them.
What are we doing?
Gotta get new wheels.
Out in the open?
Only choice.
They'll see us make the switch.
Create a diversion.
How?
I'm thinking, she said.
I was afraid of that.
With only the lightest application of the brake, she turned right and then sped southward across the blacktop lot instead of approaching the stores to the east. The pickup stayed close behind them. In the southwest sky, the two helicopters were no more than 1 mile away. They had altered course to follow the Range Rover. They were descending as they approached. The anchor store in the U-shaped complex was a supermarket in the center of the middle wing. Beyond the glass front and glass doors, the cavernous interior was filled with hard fluorescent light. Flanking that store were smaller businesses selling clothing and books and records and health foods. Other small stores filled the two end wings. The hour was still so early that most of the shops had just opened. Only the supermarket had been doing business for any length of time, and there were few parked cars other than the 20 or 30 clustered in front of that central enterprise. "Give me the pistol," she said urgently. "Put it on my lap." Spencer gave the sig to her, and then he picked up the micro Uzi from the floor between his feet. No obvious opportunity for creating a diversion awaited her toward the south. She did a hard, fishtailing U-turn and headed back north toward the center of the parking lot. That maneuver so surprised the ape that he put his pickup into a slide and almost rolled it in his eagerness to stay behind her. While regaining control at last, he stopped blowing his horn. The dog was still panting. She continued to parallel the street on which they had been traveling when she had spotted the shopping center, staying away from the stores. She said, "Anything you want to take with you?"
"Just my suitcase."
"You don't need it. I already took the money out."
"You what?"
"The 50,000 in the false bottom," she said.
"You found my money?"
He seemed astonished. "I found it."
"You took it out of the case?"
"It's right there in the canvas bag behind my seat with my laptop and some other stuff."
"You found my money?"
he repeated disbelievingly. "We'll talk about it later."
"Bet on it."
The ape in the Dodge was on her case again, blowing his horn, but he was not as close as he had been. To the southwest, the choppers were less than half a mile away and only about 100 feet off the ground, angling down. She said, "You see the bag I mean?" He looked behind her seat.
"Yeah, there, past Rocky."
After clashing with the Dodge, she wasn't sure if her door would open easily. She didn't want to have to wrestle with the bag and the door at the same time. "Take it with you when we come to a stop."
"Are we coming to a stop?" he asked.
"Oh, yeah."
A final turn, hard right. She swung into one of the center aisles in the parking lot. It led directly east to the front of the supermarket. As she approached the building, she put her hand on the horn and held it there, making even more noise than the ape was making behind her. "Oh, no," Spencer said with dawning awareness.
"Diversion," Ellie shouted.
"This is nuts."
"No choice."
"It's still nuts."
Across the face of the market, sales banners were taped to the big sections of plate glass, advertising Coke and potatoes and toilet tissue and rock salt for home water softeners. Most were along the top half of those tall panes. Through the glass, below and between the signs, Ellie could see the checkout stations. In the fluorescent light, a few clerks and customers were looking out, alerted by the strident horns. As she shot toward them, the small ovals of their face were as luminously white as the painted masks of harlequins. One woman ran, which startled the others into scattering for safety. She hoped to God they would all manage to get out of the way in time. She didn't want to hurt any innocent bystanders, but she didn't want to be gunned down by the men who would pour out of those helicopters either. Do or die. The Rover was moving fast, but not flat out. The trick was to have enough speed to jump the curb onto the wide promenade in front of the market and get through the glass wall and all the merchandise that was stacked waist-high beyond it. But at too high a speed, she would crash into the checkout stations with deadly impact.
"Gonna make it!"
Then she remembered, never lie to the dog.
"Probably."
Over the horns and the sound of the engines, she suddenly heard the chutta-chutta-chutta of the choppers. Or maybe she felt more than heard the pressure waves cast off by their rotors. They must be directly over the parking lot. The front tires rammed the curb. The Range Rover leaped. Rocky yelped, and Ellie simultaneously released the horn and took her foot off the accelerator. She tramped on the brakes as the tires slammed into the concrete. The promenade didn't seem so wide when the Rover was skidding across it at 30 or 40 miles an hour. With the scared pig squeal of hot rubber on pavement, not so very wide at all. Hell, not nearly wide enough. Her sudden awareness of the Rover's oncoming reflection was followed instantly by cascades of glass ringing down like shattered icicles. They plowed through big wooden pallets on which were stacked 50-pound bags of potatoes or some damn thing, and finally took a header into the end of a checkout station. Panels of fiberboard popped apart. The stainless steel grocery chute buckled like gift-wrapping foil. The rubber conveyor belt snapped in two and spun off its rollers and rippled into the air as if it were a giant black flatworm, and the cash register almost toppled to the floor. The impact wasn't as hard as Ellie had feared, and as if to celebrate their safe landing, gay foulards of translucent plastic bags blossomed briefly with a flourish in midair from the pockets of an invisible magician. "Okay?" she asked, releasing the buckle on her safety harness. He said, "Next time, I drive." She tried her door. It protested, screeching and grinding, but neither the brush with the Dodge nor the explosive entry into the market had jammed the latch. Grabbing the Sig 9mm that was trapped between her thighs, she clambered out of the Range Rover. Spencer had already gotten out of the other side. The morning was filled with the clatter of helicopters. The two choppers appeared on the computer screen because they had entered the boundaries of Earthguard's 200-foot lookdown. Roy sat in the second of the craft, studying the top of that very machine as it was photographed from orbit, marveling at the strange possibilities of the modern world. Because the pilot was making a straight-on approach to the target, neither the porthole on the left nor the one on the right gave Roy any view. He stayed with the computer to watch the Range Rover as it strove to elude the pickup truck by weaving back and forth across the shopping center parking lot. As the pickup tried to get back up to speed after making a bad U-turn, the Rover swung toward the central building in the complex, which was, judging by its size, a supermarket or a discount store like Walmart or Target. Only at the last moment did Roy realize that the Rover was going to ram the place. When it hit, he expected to see it rebound in a mass of flattened and tangled metal. But it disappeared, merged with the building. With horror, he realized that it had driven through an entrance or a glass wall and that the occupants had survived. He lifted the open attaché case off his lap, put it on the cabin deck in the aisle beside his seat, and bolted to his feet in alarm. He did not pause to go through the back-out security procedures with Mama, didn't disconnect, didn't unplug, but stepped over the computer and hurried toward the pilot's cabin. From what he'd seen on the display, he knew that both choppers had crossed over the power lines at the street. They were above the parking lot, easing toward touchdown, making a forward speed of only 2 or 3 miles an hour, all but hovering. They were so close to the damn woman, but now she was out of sight. Once out of sight, she might quickly be out of reach as well. Gone again. No. Intolerable. Armed and ready for action, the four Strike Force agents had gotten to their feet and were blocking the aisle near the exit. "Clear the way! Clear the way!" Roy struggled through the assembled hulks to the head of the aisle, jerked open a door, and leaned into the cramped cockpit. The pilot's attention was focused on avoiding the parking lot lampposts and the parked cars as he gentled the Jet Ranger toward the blacktop. But the second man, who was both co-pilot and navigator, turned in his seat to look at Roy as the door opened. "She drove into the damned building," Roy said, looking out through the windshield at the shattered glass along the front of the supermarket. "Wild, huh?" the co-pilot agreed, grinning. Too many cars were spread out across the blacktop to allow either chopper to put down directly in front of the market. They were angling toward opposite ends of the building, one to the north and the other to the south. Pointing at the first craft, with its full complement of 8 Strike Force agents, Roy said, "No, no, tell him I want him over the building, in back, not here, in back. All 8 of his men deployed in back, stopping everyone on foot." Their pilot was already in radio contact with the pilot of the other craft. While he hovered 20 feet over the parking lot, he repeated Roy's orders into the mouthpiece of his headset. "They'll try to go through the market and out the back," Roy said, striving to rein in his anger and remain calm. "Deep breaths. In with the pale peach vapor of blessed tranquility, out with the bile green mist of anger, tension, stress." Their chopper was hovering too low for Roy to be able to see over the roof of the market. From the Earth Guard look down on his computer, however, he remembered what lay behind the shopping center. A wide service alley, a concrete block wall, and then a housing development with numerous trees. Houses and trees. Too many places to hide. Too many vehicles to steal. North of them, just as the first Jet Ranger was about to touch down on the parking lot and disgorge its men, the pilot got Roy's message. Rotor speed picked up, and the craft began to lift into the air again.
Peach in, green out. A carpet of brown nuggets had spilled from some of the torn 50-pound bags, and they crunched under Spencer's shoes as he got out of the rover and ran between two checkout stations. He carried the canvas bag by its straps. In the other hand, he clutched the Uzi. He glanced to his left. Ellie was paralleling him in the next checkout lane. The shopping aisles were long and ran front to back of the store. He met Ellie at the head of the nearest aisle. "Out the back!" She hurried toward the rear of the supermarket. Starting after her, he remembered Rocky. The mutt had gotten out of the rover behind him. Where was Mr. Rocky Dog? He stopped, spun around, ran back two steps, and saw the hapless canine in the checkout lane that he himself had used. Rocky was eating some of the brown nuggets that hadn't been crushed under his master's shoes. Dry dog food, 50 pounds or more of it.
"Rocky!"
The mutt looked up and wagged his tail.
"Come on!"
Rocky didn't even consider the command. He snatched up a few more nuggets, crunching them with delight.
"Rocky!"
The dog regarded him again, one ear up and one down, bushy tail banging against the side of the cashier's counter. In his sternest voice, Spencer said,
"Mine!"
Regretful but obedient, a little ashamed, Rocky trotted away from the food. When he saw Ellie, who had stopped halfway down the long aisle to wait for them, he broke into a sprint. Ellie resumed her flight, and Rocky dashed exuberantly past her, unaware that they were running for their lives. At the end of the aisle, three men rushed into sight from the left and halted when they saw Ellie, Spencer, the dog, the guns. Two were in white uniforms, names stitched on their shirt pockets, employees of the market. The third, in street clothes with a loaf of French bread in one hand, must have been a customer. With an alacrity and sinuosity more like that of a cat, Rocky transformed his headlong plunge into an immediate retreat. Eeling around on himself, tail between his legs, almost on his belly, he waddled back toward his master for protection. The men were startled, not aggressive, but they froze, blocking the way.
"Back off!"
Spencer shouted. Aiming at the ceiling, he punctuated his demand with a short burst from the Uzi, blowing out a fluorescent strip and precipitating a shower of light bulb glass and chopped up acoustic tiles. Terrified, the three men scattered. A pair of swinging doors at the back of the market was recessed between dairy cases to the left and lunch meat and cheese coolers to the right. Ellie slammed through the doors. Spencer followed with Rocky. They were in a short hallway with rooms to both sides. The sound of the helicopters was muffled there. At the end of the hallway, they burst into a cavernous room that extended the width of the building. Bare concrete walls, fluorescent lights, open rafters instead of a suspended ceiling. An area in the center of the chamber was open, but merchandise in shipping cartons was stacked 16 feet high in aisles on both sides. Additional stock of products, from shampoo to fresh produce. Spencer spotted a few stockroom employees watching warily from between the storage aisles. Directly ahead, beyond the open work area, was an enormous metal roll-up door through which big trucks could be backed inside and unloaded. To the right of the shipping entrance was a man-sized door. They ran to it, opened it, and went outside into the 50-foot-wide service alley. No one in sight. A 20-foot-deep overhang sprouted from the wall above the roll-up. It extended the length of the market, jutting nearly halfway across the alley to allow additional trucks to pull under it and unload while protected from the elements. It was also protection from the eyes in the sky. The morning was surprisingly chilly. Though the market and stockroom had been cool, Spencer wasn't prepared for the briskness of the outside air. The temperature must have been in the mid-40s. In more than 2 hours of breakneck travel, they had come from the edge of a desert into higher altitudes and a different climate. He saw no point in following the service alley left or right. Both ways, they would only be going around the U-shaped structure to the parking lot out front. On three sides of the shopping center, a 9-foot-high privacy wall separated it from its neighbors, concrete blocks painted white, capped with bricks. If it had been 6 feet, they might have scaled it fast enough to escape. 9 feet, no way in hell. They could throw the canvas bag across easy enough, but they couldn't simply heave a 70-pound dog to the other side and hope he landed well. Out at the front of the supermarket, the pitch of the engines from at least one of the helicopters changed. The clatter of its props grew louder. It was coming to the rear of the building. Ellie dashed to the right along the shaded back of the market. Spencer knew what she intended. They had one hope. He followed her. She stopped at the limit of the overhang, which marked the end of the supermarket. Beyond was that portion of the back wall of the shopping center belonging to neighboring businesses. Ellie glowered at Rocky. "Stay close to the building, tight against it," she told him, as if he could understand. Maybe he could. Ellie hurried out into the sunshine, heeding her own advice, and Rocky trotted between her and Spencer, staying close to the back wall of the shopping center. Spencer didn't know if satellite surveillance was acute enough to differentiate between them and the structure.
He didn't know if the 2-foot overhang on the main roof high above provided cover, but even if Ellie's strategy was smart, Spencer still felt watched. The stuttering thunder of the chopper grew louder. Judging by the sound, it was up and out of the front parking lot, starting across the roof. South of the supermarket, the first business was a dry cleaner. A small sign bearing the name of the shop was posted on the employee entrance. Locked. The sky was full of apocalyptic sound. Beyond the dry cleaner was a Hallmark card shop. The service door was unlocked. Ellie yanked it open. Roy Miro leaned through the cockpit door to watch as the other chopper rose higher than the building, hovered for a moment, then angled across the roof toward the back of the supermarket. Pointing to a clear area of blacktop just south of the market, for the benefit of his own pilot, Roy said, "There, smack in front of Hallmark. Put us down right there." As the pilot took them down the last 20 feet and maneuvered to the desired landing point, Roy joined the 4 agents at the door in the passenger cabin, breathing deeply. Peach in, green out. He pulled the Beretta from his shoulder holster. The silencer was still fitted to the weapon. He removed it and dropped it in an inside jacket pocket. This wasn't a clandestine operation that required silencers, not with all the attention they were attracting, and the pistol would allow more accuracy without the trajectory distortion caused by a silencer. They touched down. One of the strike team agents slid the door out of the way, and they exited rapidly, one after the other, into the battering downdraft from the rotor blades. As Spencer followed Ellie and Rocky through the door into the back room of the card shop, he glanced up into cannonades of sound. Silhouetted against the icy blue sky straight overhead, the outer edges of the rotors appeared first, chopping through the dry Utah air. Then the glide slope antenna on the nose of the craft eased into view. As the leading edge of the downdraft hit him, he stepped inside and pulled the door shut, barely in time to avoid being seen. The deadbolt had a brass thumb turn on the inside of the door. Although the hit squad would focus first on the back of the market, Spencer engaged the lock. They were in a narrow, windowless storeroom that smelled of rose-scented air freshener. Ellie opened the next door before Spencer had closed the first. Beyond the storeroom was a small office with overhead fluorescents, 2 desks, a computer, files. 2 more doors led out of there. One stood half open to a tiny bathroom, toilet and sink. The other connected the office to the shop itself. The long, narrow store was crowded with pyramidal island displays of cards, carousels of more cards, gift wrap, puzzles, stuffed toys, decorative candles, and novelties. The current promotion was for Valentine's Day, and there was an abundance of overhead banners and decorative wall hangings, all hearts and flowers. The festiveness of the place was an unsettling reminder that, regardless of what happened to him and Ellie and Rocky in the next few minutes, the world would spin on unheeding. If they were shot dead in Hallmark, their bodies would be hauled away, the blood would be expunged from the carpet, a rose-scented air freshener would be employed in generous sprays, a few more potpourri might be set out for sale, and the stream of lovers coming in to buy cards would continue all but unabated. 2 women, evidently employees, were at the glass storefront, backs turned. They stared out at the activity in the parking lot. Ellie started toward them. Following her, Spencer suddenly wondered if she intended to take hostages. He didn't like that idea, not at all. Jesus, no. These agency people, as she had described them and as he had seen them in action, wouldn't hesitate to blow away a hostage, even a woman or a child, to get at their target. Especially not early in an operation, when witnesses were the most confused and no reporters were yet on the scene with cameras. He didn't want innocent blood on his hands. Of course, they couldn't merely wait in Hallmark until the agency went away. When they weren't found in the supermarket, the search would surely spread to adjacent stores. Their best chance to escape was to slip out the front door of the card shop while the hit team's attention remained focused on the supermarket, try to get to a parked car and hotwire it. Not much of a chance. As thin as paper, as thin as hope itself, but it was all they had. Better than hostages, so he clung to it. With the chopper landing virtually at the back door, the card shop was so hammered by the screaming of engines and the pounding of rotor blades that it couldn't have been noisier if it had been under an amusement park roller coaster. The Valentine banners trembled overhead. Hundreds of novelty key rings jangled from the hooks of a display stand. A collection of small ornate picture frames rattled against the glass shelf on which they stood. Even the walls of the store seemed to thrum like drumheads. The racket was so ungodly that he wondered about the shopping center. It must be cheapjack construction, the worst crap, if one chopper could set up such reverberations in its walls. They were almost to the front of the store, 15 feet from the women at the window, when the reason for the fearful tumult became obvious. The second helicopter settled down in front of the shop, beyond the covered promenade, in the parking lot. The store was bracketed by the machines, shaken by cross vibrations. Ellie halted at the sight of the chopper. Rocky seemed less worried by the cacophony than by an unfurled poster of Beethoven, the movie star St. Bernard, not the composer of symphonies, and he shied from it, taking refuge behind Ellie's legs. The two women at the window were still unaware that they had company. They were side by side, chattering excitedly, and though their voices were raised above the clamor of the machines, their words were unintelligible to Spencer. As he stepped to Ellie's side, gazing at the chopper with dread, he saw a door slide open on the fuselage. Armed men jumped to the blacktop, one after the other. The first was carrying a submachine gun larger than Spencer's micro-Uzi. The second had an automatic rifle. The third toted a pair of grenade-launching rifles, no doubt equipped with stun, sting, or gas payloads. The fourth man was armed with a submachine gun, and the fifth had only a pistol. The fifth man was the last, and he was different from the four hulks who preceded him. Shorter, somewhat pudgy. He held his pistol to one side, aimed at the ground, and ran with less athletic grace than his companions. None of the five approached the card shop. They raced toward the front of the supermarket, moving quickly out of view. The chopper's engine was idling. The blades were still turning, though at a lower speed. The hit team hoped to be in and out fast. "Ladies," Ellie said. The women didn't hear her over the still considerable noise of the helicopters and of their own excited conversation. Ellie raised her voice.
"Ladies, damn it!"
Startled, exclaiming, wide-eyed, they turned. Ellie didn't point the Sig 9mm at them, but she made sure they got a good look at it. "Get away from those windows. Come here." They hesitated, glanced at each other, at the pistol. "I don't want to hurt you," Ellie was unmistakably sincere, "but I'll do what I have to if you don't come here right now." The women stepped away from the storefront windows, one of them moving slower than the other. The slowpoke cast a furtive glance at the nearby entrance door. "Don't even think about it," Ellie told her. "I'll shoot you in the back, so help me God, and if you aren't killed, you'll be in a wheelchair forever." "Okay, yeah, that's better. Come here." Spencer stepped aside, and Rocky hid behind him, as Ellie guided the frightened women along the aisle. Halfway through the store, she made them lie down, one behind the other, with their heads toward the back wall. "If either of you looks up any time in the next 15 minutes, I'll kill you both," Ellie told them. Spencer didn't know if she was as sincere this time as when she had told him that she didn't want to hurt them, but she sounded as though she were. If he had been one of the women, he wouldn't have raised his head to look around until at least Easter. Returning to him, Ellie said, "Pilot's still in the chopper." He moved a few steps closer to the front of the store. Through the side window of the cockpit, one of the crew was visible, probably the co-pilot. "Two of them, I'm sure." "They don't take part in the assault?" Ellie asked. "No, of course not. They're flyers, not gunmen." She went to the door and looked north toward the front of the supermarket. "Have to do it. No time to think about it. We just have to do it." Spencer didn't even need to ask what she was talking about. She was an instinctive survivor with 14 hard months of combat experience under her belt, and he remembered most of what the United States Army Rangers had taught him about strategy and about thinking on his feet. They couldn't go back the way they'd come, couldn't stay in the card shop either. Eventually, it would be searched. They could no longer hope to reach a car in the parking lot and hotwire it behind the backs of the gunmen, because all the cars were parked in front of the chopper, requiring them to pass in full view of its crew. They were left with one option, one terrible, desperate option. It required boldness, courage, and either a dash of fatalism or an enormous measure of brainless self-confidence. They were both ready to do it. "Take this," he said, handing her the canvas bag. "This, too." And then gave her the Uzi. As he took the SIG from her and tucked it under the waistband of his jeans against his belly, she said, "I guess you have to. It's a 3-second dash at most, even less for him, but we can't risk him freezing up." Spencer squatted, scooped up Rocky, and stood with the dog cradled like a child in his arms. Rocky didn't know whether to wag his tail or be afraid, whether they were having fun or were in big trouble. He was clearly on the brink of sensory overload. In that condition, he customarily either went all limp and quivery or flew into a frenzy of terror. Ellie eased open the door to check the front of the supermarket. Glancing at the two women on the floor, Spencer saw that they were obeying the instructions they'd been given. "Now," Ellie said, stepping outside, holding the door for him. He went through sideways so as not to bash Rocky's head into the doorframe. Stepping onto the covered shopping promenade, he glanced toward the market. All but one of the gunmen had gone inside. A thug with submachine guns remained outside, facing away from them. In the chopper, the co-pilot was looking down at something on his lap, not out the side window of the cockpit. Half convinced that Rocky weighed 700 rather than 70 pounds, Spencer sprinted to the open door in the helicopter fuselage. It was only a 30-foot dash, even counting the 10-foot width of the promenade, but those were the longest 30 feet in the universe, a quirk of physics, an eerie scientific anomaly, a bizarre distortion in the fabric of creation, stretching ever longer in front of him as he ran. And then he was there, pushing the dog inside, scrambling up and into the craft himself. Ellie was so close behind him that she might as well have been his backpack. She dropped the canvas bag the moment she was up and across the threshold, but she held on to the Uzi. Unless someone was crouched behind one of the 10 seats, the passenger compartment was deserted. Just to be safe, Ellie moved back down the aisle, checking left and right. Spencer stepped to the nearby cockpit door, opened it. He was just in time to jam the muzzle of the pistol in the face of the co-pilot, who was starting to get up from his seat. "Take us up," Spencer told the pilot. The two men appeared even more surprised than the women in the card shop. "Take us up now, or I'll blow this asshole's brains out through that window, then yours!" Spencer shouted so forcefully that he sprayed the crewman with spittle and felt the veins in his temples popping up like those in a weightlifter's biceps. He thought he sounded every bit as frightening as Ellie. Just inside the shattered glass wall of the supermarket, beside the wrecked Range Rover, in a drift of dog food, Roy and three agents stood with their weapons aimed at a tall man with a flat face, yellow teeth, and coal-black eyes as cold as a viper's. The guy clutched a semi-automatic rifle in both hands, and though he wasn't aiming it at anyone, he looked mean enough and angry enough to use it on the baby Jesus himself. He was the driver of the pickup. His Dodge stood abandoned in the parking lot, one door hanging wide open. He had come inside either to seek vengeance for whatever had happened on the highway, or to play the hero. "Drop the gun," Roy repeated for the third time.
"Says who?"
"Says who?"
"That's right."
"Are you a moron? Am I talking to a blithering idiot here? You see four guys holding heavy weapons on you, and you don't understand the logic of dropping that rifle?"
"You cops or what?"
asked the viper-eyed man. Roy wanted to kill him. No more formalities. The guy was too damn stupid to live. He'd be better off dead. A sad case. Society would be better off without him, too. Cut him down. Right there. Right now. And then find the woman and Grant. The only problem was that Roy's dream of a 3-minute mission, in and out and away before the nosy local showed up, was no longer achievable. The operation had gone sour when the hateful woman had driven into the market, and it was getting more sour by the moment. Well, hell, it was past sour into bitter. They were going to have to deal with Cedar City cops, and that was going to be more difficult if one of the residents they were sworn to protect was lying dead on a mound of Purina dog chow. If they were going to have to work with locals, he might as well show a badge to this fool. From an inner jacket pocket, he withdrew an ID wallet, flipped it open, and flashed his phony credentials. Drug Enforcement Administration.
"Well, sure," the man said. "Oh, that's all right."
He lowered the gun to the floor, let go of it. Then he actually put one hand to the bill of his baseball cap and tipped it at Roy with what seemed to be sincere respect. Roy said, "You go sit in the back of your truck, not inside, in the open, behind the cab. You wait there. You try to leave, that guy outside with a machine gun will cut your legs off at the knees."
"Yes, sir."
With convincing solemnity, he tipped his cap again, and then he walked out through the damaged front wall of the store. Roy almost turned and shot him in the back. "Peach in, green out. Spread out across the front of the store," he told his men, "and wait. Keep alert." The team coming in from the back would search the supermarket exhaustively, flushing out Grant and the woman if they tried to hide anywhere inside. The fugitives would be driven forward and forced either to surrender or to die in a barrage of gunfire. The woman, of course, would be shot to death whether she tried to surrender or not. They were taking no more chances with her. "There will be employees and customers coming through," he called out to his three men as they deployed across the store to both sides of him. "Don't let anybody leave. Herd them over near the manager's office. Even if you think they have no resemblance to the pair we're looking for, hold them. Even if it's the Pope, you hold him." Outside, the helicopter engine went from a low idle to a loud roar. The pilot revved it again. "What the hell?" Frowning, Roy clambered through the debris and went outside to see what was happening.